This is FNX.
Listen to Shoot the Defense. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Shooter Defense exclusively on the FNX Network. I'm your host, Stel, as ever. And before I introduce my guest, I'd just like to dedicate this episode to everyone who's trying their level best to make it in the media industry on their own. The people who haven't got anyone to turn to for advice or keep hitting a brick wall despite seeing a glimmer of hope. Now, there are lots of people I've worked with over the past 7 years of doing Shooter Defense. Some have come and gone, have gone on to do better things, and I'm very, very proud of them, very pleased for them. These days, people like to shoot other people down in the media. You do have a lot of good people, and I've seen the fantastic side of media. I've got my UEFA broadcasting accreditation. I was at the Champions League final in Cardiff a couple seasons ago, and it was an incredible experience. But then you have the darker side of the media. People that are only out there for themselves. People that don't look after other people. Now, that's all well and good because, you know, each their own, so to speak. You know, you want to go it alone, that's fine. But see, this is the thing. I've always wanted to help people because when I first started doing Shooter Defense 7 years ago, no one really gave me much support. But there are some people that have stuck by me through thick and thin. And there are a lot of people that are still doing bits in the media who have come to me for advice, and I've turned to them because I've needed a bit of a kick up the arse. And looking at the way that these guys have turned things around, I've been in awe of them, you know? I'm talking about Conor Dunford, who started doing his podcast, didn't feel he was going anywhere, but we had a heart-to-heart, and now he's doing bits for Breaking the Lines. I'm talking about Harry Simeu, who I hold in highest regard. You know, the lad has, I've known for Harry for what, 3 years? Two, 3 years? You know, we had the discussion, we gave each other ideas. He took the baton, he ran with it. And he's doing extremely well with Sofa Sports News, with Chronicles of Aguna. He's got his Serie A show. I'm talking about E-Man from the 4231 podcast. Another fine gentleman who is very, very intelligent, knows the game like the back of his hand, and isn't afraid to do things different. I'm talking about Kojo and the Three Midfield Guys. A fantastic podcast. Organic, real, genuine. I'm talking about D-Man and Double D from the D&D Footy Factory. Another fantastic podcast. These guys work their backsides off every Saturday morning. They're in the studio talking football. Some people are hungover Saturday morning. These guys are up at the crack of dawn to do their podcast. What about Joe Uccello and Roberto Rojas, Low Limit Football Podcast? Roberto Rojas has been working his backside off to get exclusive stories on Miguel Almirón's move to Newcastle. And boy, is he doing well. Joe Uccello has been steadying the ship for that podcast for years. Over 200 episodes. Strong. Footy Says. Another fantastic show. The concept is very clever. They record it in a barbershop where many conversations about football go on. It's a brilliant show. I've had the pleasure to be on it. And I trust that anyone listening to this goes on YouTube and watches the show. Colossal Chig, the Arsenal fan, the guy I've known for what, 5 years? Over 3,000 subscribers on YouTube on his Arsenal channel. There are many names I've probably missed out. There's Lee Gunner. Does a few bits for Arsenal Fan TV. How many subscribers has he got on YouTube now? 10,000? Crazy. But see, this is the thing. These guys, they don't put their hand out and expect things. They work their backsides off. They work hard. They don't have people spoon-feeding them. They don't have big corporations behind them. These guys are real as real can be. And this is why I dedicate this specific show to them. Because they might call me uncle as a joke, but I admire him, and I see him as family. The FNX family, at that. So here goes. My interview. My guest had spells at Ajax, Dortmund. He played alongside the likes of Del Piero, Edgar Davids, Antonio Conte, Zinedine Zidane during his time at Juventus. My guest is etched in African football history. He starred in Nigeria's 1994 AFCON victory and played a pivotal role in their gold medal success at the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. I'm not done yet. Known for his tenacity, tough tackling and perfect timing when releasing the ball on the counter, his finest individual moment came at the 1998 World Cup, where his 30-yard thunderbolt earned Nigeria a famous victory against Spain. This interview is dedicated to every single person that's listening to this and doesn't believe they can get anywhere in the media industry. Trust me, you can believe and you can achieve. This is my interview with a legend that is Sunday Olise. Sunday, your career began at Julius Berger Football Club, now known as Bridge FC. What can you tell me about the early stages of your career back home?
Well, I played soccer like most kids in Nigeria. That means playing on the streets of Lagos. And I'm in school. That was just how my soccer development started. And eventually I was able to be fortunate enough to be signed at a very young age to a first division team in the Nigerian League, and where I played just for a short time before I came into Europe.
Knowing what I do about Nigerian culture, I can safely say that education is a top priority. What school did you go to, and did football get in the way of your studies?
Yeah, football did. I went to school in Lagos, and well, not that football got into my studies. I think the studies also helped my football,
right,
in the sense that we had also free education periods where we played soccer mainly, and that is just how it really got some form of organized competitive football. So that's how it is.
You were about 17 years old when you moved to RFC Liège. Was Belgium a big culture shock for you?
Well, I came into Belgium at a very, very tender age. I was just 16 when I got there. And it was everything was different. It was different. The atmosphere was different. The weather, the food, language, culture, everything was totally different. So I had to learn them. I had to learn the language also when I first got into Belgium. But what has helped me all through my career is the ability to learn and quickly speak languages in countries that I play in. That makes it easier for me to communicate and most of the time to know what the gaffer is talking about.
Okay, so a brief spell at Reggiana followed where, if I'm not mistaken, you played alongside the likes of Paolo Futre, Massimo Brambilla and Michel Padovano. Now, that's another move at a very young age. What were the noticeable differences between Belgium and Italian football?
Well, the Belgian football was open. And when I got to Italy, then I learned that football was not about... It was just all about results. Everything we did, everything that was done in Italy was based on results. Very little to the gallery of fans. And a lot of the players were more built to keep the zero, not to concede, and the foreign players were normally supposed to make the difference as regards getting results offensively or defensively, as the case may be. But the Italian league was more compact, more solid, and more tactical at the time. Unlike it's nothing to do with what it is now. But in the 90s, it was just total result-oriented football.
Right. You've also played for three clubs in Germany. What is it about the Bundesliga that makes it so different from the other leagues you've played in?
Ah, the Bundesliga. I think the Bundesliga is the best league in the world.
Okay.
It's the most complete league in the world. It's the league where you have offensive, defensive, mid-play, transition. It's everything physical and to a large extent technical. And it's the best organized league, in my opinion. And what makes the league special is the fact that, one, people don't take note of this, but it's the league that has the most fans in the stadium every weekend. Most of the clubs like Borussia Dortmund, you get 83,000 in the stadium. Most stadiums have 50,000. FC Cologne in the second league are now playing in front of 50,000 every week, every other weekend. So the league is special. It's very well organized. As a player, you don't have to have any worries for your financial payments. It's always well organized. It's just where I think I polished my coaching, what my coaching could be like, and while playing in Germany.
Big learning curve then.
Yeah, it was. It really was every day.
Okay, so let's switch gears a bit and talk about 1994, which was a pivotal year as you were not only part of the victorious African Cup of Nations team, but also selected for the World Cup in the USA. Aside from winning AFCON outright, what would you say are the most memorable moments from both competitions?
The AFCON 94 is, for me, is very, very special. It's a really special tournament. In fact, special in the sense that it was my first major tournament for Nigeria. We were playing in Tunisia, which was not back home. And we were not, we were favorites coming in, and we were able to win it. As a team, it was really great because we had some great football that we exhibited there as a team. But on an individual note, it was just the breakthrough for me at the highest level because we started the tournament. I was blessed to be the one who gave the pass for the opening goal for my team by Rashidi Yekini. May he so rest in peace. And the winning goal to win the tournament, I gave the assist again to Manuel Amunike to give it. So it was like I opened the tournament and I closed it for my country. So it was really exceptional and special for me.
Right, fast forward 2 years and you found yourself back in the States, famously winning gold at the Atlanta Olympics. This was quite literally Nigeria's golden generation, a squad full of household names who really put African football on the map. Tell me about the atmosphere in the camp before the competition started. How confident were you all going into it?
We're not confident we're going to win it, but we knew we had a good team. We knew we had a special team, and we were hungry. We were really, really hungry. The whole team. We were one of the first nations to get to America for preparations. We did all our preparations there. We had very little resources to prepare for it. At one point, we slept in motels.
Wow.
And we had players who really wanted to invest, who wanted to make a point at the time. Young, hungry, unknown at the highest level. Players, we had talents like JJ Okocha. We had Tijani Babangida. We had Kanu Nwankwo, Emmanuel Amunike. Daniel Amokachi was there. Uche Okechukwu was there. Dosu Joseph. We had such a great team. And Celestine Babayaro. You know, these were just very, very good players. But at the time, had not exploded yet. But we're getting ready to explode. In fact, we started exploding already before. But it was just that the Brazilian one was the most mediatized game. Because we already qualified before. In our group stages, we had Brazil in our group. We qualified before the last game. We already had 6 points. So the last game we had to, our aim of playing the last game was not even to top the group, was to kick Brazil out because they had lost 1-1. And unfortunately, we lost that game. And then we beat in the quarterfinals, Mexico 2-0. We dominated them hands down. And the Brazilian game also with all the stars, that was when Nigeria really came on scene. And there was nothing better than the final game, you know, losing 2-1 and coming back to win 3-2 in a final game that's, the whole world was just looking at, and it was really special for us.
Okay, let's talk about that famous semi-final against Brazil then. As you know, Nigeria were 3-1 down at half-time. What was actually said in the dressing room? Did the team believe they could turn it around?
You see, one thing about that team, and that's why I hold every player who was part of that team dear, is the fact that we did not need any outside influence to motivate each other. We did not need anybody to criticize the team because when we went into the dressing room, we just auto-criticized one another. Hey, my man, I'm moving you not. Come on, move. Do this, do that, there. And then the coach would come in and add his own thing to it. But we motivated each other and we were like encouraging each other. Okay, it will get better in the second half. You know, we have to push it. We didn't come here. We have to take something back home. Our ambition in the semifinals was we had to take something back home, and that was at least the bronze medal. Unknown to us that God had prepared the gold medal, so...
Okay, so Ikpeba pulled it back to 3-2 with 12 minutes to go before Kanu scored the kind of goal only Kanu can score, really, especially in the 90th minute. You must have believed you were going to win it in extra time, surely.
The moment we equalised them, we knew we had them because when we equalised, we saw the detection on them. And furthermore, their talisman was out already. Ronaldo was out. He had hurt himself, so he was not there to play the extra time. So I'm talking of Ronaldo da Lima.
Online,
yeah. So he was, yeah, because then they had this great team. They had Ronaldo, they had Bebeto, they had Roberto Carlos, they had Aldaí, they had Rivaldo. They had just an array of stars. But he was out. He was one who was really, really bothering us offensively. And then we're fortunate to have been able to win it with a golden goal.
The path to glory at the Olympics was somewhat poetic given Argentina beat Nigeria at the group stage in the 94 World Cup. This time around, it was Nigeria's turn to be victorious, having twice come from behind to win a dramatic game. Not for the first time, mind. Now, when Crespo put them 2-1 in front, you and your teammates showed the kind of composure and discipline as in the semi-final to bounce back and win the game. Can you describe the scenes involving you and your teammates at full time?
When the referee blew the whistle, it dawned on us that we had done something extraordinary. Because when he blew it, it was like we went ecstatic. We started doing our Africa dance as a team. We saw the stadium go wild. We saw Americans, you know, it was like the whole stadium were there for us. And the best part was seeing the Argentine fans also clap for us. Mm. That was just, it was just it. And the fact that we had now taken our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable. And with very young players, so it was good.
Nigeria's Olympic gold was truly a fairy tale. What were the celebrations like at full time and back home?
Oh, they went crazy. At the time we were playing that game, it was midnight Nigeria time when we started. So you can imagine that when the referee blew the final whistle, it was 2 a.m.
Wow.
and the whole country was awake. And we were so excited to the point whereby the president of the country at the time, he went on national television immediately after the game and declared 2 days free, no work. Wow. And so that tells you how important it was to Nigeria, wow, the Olympics gold.
Can you imagine if Nigeria ever win the World Cup? Can you imagine what that would be like? Wow.
Well, one thing is for sure, if Nigeria win the World Cup, I don't think the country will work for a week or a month. So, I think the players will be part of that and the technical crew will be part of that. I don't think they might need to work for the rest of their lives also. So it's going to be like that.
Okay, so a move to Ajax in 1997 occurred and you played alongside the likes of Laudrup, Richard Vitschke and compatriot Tijani Babangida. What can you tell us about your time at the club and what makes Ajax so special from a player's perspective?
Oh, it's the best club to play as a soccer player. It's especially if you're a young and developing player, because going to training at Ajax, especially during the 90s, every day was like a school. There was something we were working on. You know, it was there. In fact, it was in 1998 that I decided that when I quit football, I was going to become a soccer coach while I was playing at Ajax. Because it was obvious that you see the superstars who come out of Ajax, sometimes it's not as if they are talented exceptionally, but they specialize in so many departments of the game by working and working on it, you know, learning how to move, when to move. And that just became clear that if you have your principles and your playing culture and, of course, some talent, you can get it. And Ajax is very organized. All you have to do is think about playing. Every other thing is catered for.
Yeah, so It's a very, very special club. Even at the stadium tour, you can tell how special this club is, you know, to football.
It's a club that holds its own culture of what how it wants football to be played, what it wants to, and try to stick to it. Of course, it is costing them a lot of titles now at the moment because world football has changed. And unfortunately, Cruyff is not there again to, or somebody like Cruyff to like ignite that update that the Ajax system needs. But if the moment that update comes in again, Ajax will dominate the world again.
Before moving to Juve in 99, you scored the most famous World Cup goal in Nigerian football history against Spain. You've described it as one of the best moments in your life. Talk us through the goal, please.
Well, I think what made that goal special was the situation before that game itself. Going into the tournament, the World Cup 98, we had lost practically almost every friendly game we played. And we were just humiliated a week before when we played our last game in Holland against the Dutch. We lost 5-1, I think, at the Ajax Arena. So going into the opening game against Spain, that had played, I think, 23 games at the time and had not lost one, for us, it was kind of special. And each time again, we brought back some of the 96 phenomenon again. That means we were one goal down, we came back 1-1, 2-1, we came back to 2. And being able to score that kind of a goal on the world stage where the whole world is watching, I think that was the best way God helped my family's name to be cemented in world soccer.
And against one of the best goalkeepers ever as well, because Zubizarreta was fantastic.
Yeah, Zubizarreta. He was, funny enough, I watched him play so many years at Barcelona, you know, especially at the time when he was goalkeeper there with the Cruyff era. You know, so exceptional goalkeeper.
At Juve, you teamed up with Van der Sar again, but also with Del Piero, Antonio Conte, Edgar Davids, and a certain Zinedine Zidane. Each of those legends had their own unique qualities, Sunday, but what did you learn most from them?
Well, I think it's not a question of learning from them. If there's a player I learned anything from, it was Zidane. Right. But if you're talking of what I got from Juventus, was more from the team. Everything is about the club. The club is organized. It's not organized like the average Italian club. It's organized like as one of the probably the best, one of the best organized clubs in the world. Everything is catered for. The Agnelli family manages the club like they manage the Fiat companies. You know, as if it's and that gives. As a soccer player, they tell you when you come. Anything you need, you get it. But all you have to do is just play football. And it's but Zidane, I learned a lot of things from him. One of them is how to be humble and really work hard on your skills. Because in as much as you know, a lot is said about this man, but he's probably the best teammate I ever had. Very talented, humble, hardworking, focused. And he's blessed.
Well, as you know, Zidane is regarded as one of the top 10 footballers ever, but you've played with others who are equally as creative, like Okocha and Laudrup. From what you've experienced, what makes Zidane stand out more, though?
Well, everything the others can do, no matter anything that they could do at their best, he could do it like 10, 15, 20% more, better. Right. Like if it comes to ball control techniques, exceptional, passing, shooting, even headers, you know, he was totally complete. And the capability to be a player that a real playmaker, if you have difficulties, play him the ball. He will find a solution. Play him the ball. He will find a solution. Sometimes you play him the ball in just one touch, he opens the game up. And as a human being, I found him, compared to the other stars I played with at Juventus, for example, he was probably the most modest. He drove one of the smallest cars. He was very family-oriented. He always had his family around him. His brothers were always there, the wife and everything. And very hardworking, you know.
Now, Sunday, we've seen many racist incidents throughout Europe this season. Were you ever a victim of racism? And if so, how did you deal with it?
Racism is a difficult issue. Personally, I've had it on so many occasions when I was a soccer player. I've experienced it also as a coach on so many occasions. But it's something that I just accept that it's always going to be there. And I think my philosophy in life is succeed in spite of it. Because I don't know if it's ever going to be erased in my time, because it's something that existed way back to the time of Jesus Christ. So I don't know how we're going to deal with it, but it changes forms. It changes. You can't even attack it anymore because it's no longer open mind, openly put out there like it used to be. But I think the best way to handle it is don't make it your problem. Let it be the other man's problem. If a man is racist, it's his problem. Just try to... It's very difficult, huh? It's very difficult. And it's painful sometimes. Sometimes you want to strike back. You want to hit at something. But if you do it, you end up even losing more. So the best thing is just to succeed in spite of it. But then, that notwithstanding, the authorities, it's up to them to take measures so that this stops, at least in soccer.
Yeah, I don't think they're doing enough, to be honest. I always believe they should deduct teams' points because that would really hurt teams. And I know people will say to me, well, it's not really the teams that are doing it, it's the fans. But either way, if you start deducting teams' points or disqualifying them from cup competitions, then that should surely tone it down, at least.
I totally agree with you. The easiest way to bring about change is to bring responsibility. If you're responsible for your acts, I think, and if it's punitive actions against you are firm enough, it makes you think twice before you do those acts every time. So, like what you said, I agree with it, but the authorities have to handle it.
On a final note, Sunday, before we wrap this up, I'd just like to hear your views on the current Nigeria squad. As you know, there are many young players playing their trade in Europe's top leagues, like Alex Iwobi, Ola Aina, Torino, Iheanacho, and Isaac Success, to name a few. What's your take on the future of Nigerian football, and can the national team become the first African nation to win a World Cup?
We have everything to win the World Cup. Nigeria is in the sense that when you have 180 million people who are passionate about football almost religiously, and we have the number one spot absolute back home. So you have numbers, you have talent, you have everything to win it. The only what is missing in Nigeria is just organization and discipline. And what I know from firsthand is that if you try to bring organization and discipline, you will be put out. You will be frustrated. Whereas, unfortunately, that is the only way the country can really win titles. Because I think by the time we improve our overview, our total view of the game itself, and now we should go forward, I think Nigeria will be unbeatable. For example, when we understand that football is no longer based on just assembling star players to play, but the players have to get talented players together, but at the same time, there has to be a principle or a playing philosophy behind it. So I think then it will work out. It's no longer individuals who win games now. It's more the team that wins tournaments.
So, guys, that was my interview with Sunday Olise. A very charming man, a very intelligent man, and as you can tell, a man with so much experience in the game. Hope you enjoyed it. You can give us a follow on Twitter at ShootTheDefence. Follow our friends over at the FNX Network. Visit fnx.network. And that's about it. So until next time, guys, take care.